It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 241, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, search problems, hosting videos, moving servers, and why? But don't ask why.
So, Gary, how's life in Denver this week?
Pretty good, cold, wintry, and all of that.
We actually broke out of our snow and cold. It's back to moderate, mild, and wet.
Pacific Northwest.
One of the measures, of course, is how wet are the dogs when they come back in from being outside? And it's back to being soaking wet because they're so low to the ground. So we were talking before we started recording about the search on our own site, the searches we use on our own site.
Yes.
And halfway through, we realized that, gosh, this would be really interesting for other folks to listen to. Mm-hmm. The reason it came up is that on Ask Leo, I have struggled for years to come up with a really good search solution. I push search hard. If you ever go to one of my Ask a Question pages, like there's a paragraph right in front of the field that says search first. In fact, it's almost annoying in how strong it says that. And I honestly say in that text that half the time, the questions that people are asking me are already answered on the site if they would just search for it.
Yeah, that's half probably same for me.
But the problem, of course, is that that has the assumption that the search engine is, whichever search engine you're using, is actually going to find the right piece of content, be it an article or a video or whatever. And that's where things kind of sort of tend to go off the rails. For a long time, I was using Google, both their revenue generating product, right, where you run the search query through Google, you display ads with your Google search results, and AdSense, you get a little bit of revenue. I went to generic Google for a while, which was okay, but it was still Google. They were inserting ads and it was sometimes misleading and so forth. I went to a third-party solution that's available for WordPress sites. It's called Algolia, and it allows you to basically set up your own quote-unquote search engine. They basically maintain the data offsite on their servers so that when you do a search on my site, it sends the search query out to them. They run it through their database much more quickly and get results. Either I don't know how to use it well, or I just wasn't able to tweak it to my satisfaction, but I was never really satisfied with the results. So I dropped back to using WordPress's built-in search. I have, I think everybody knows that Ask Leo is built on WordPress, which gives me tons of functionality, one of which is a search. The search is, I don't want to say basic, I think there's more to it than that, but in a few examples, it's better. In other words, I go looking for something on my own site, and before, I wouldn't find it, even though I knew it was there. And after, of course, I would, using the WordPress's own site. Now, I suspect a part of that is a side effect of a difference between me, and presumably you, Gary, and a quote-unquote normal person, in that we search based on the keywords we know. Right. If I want to find an article about using OneDrive for a specific purpose, I know the keywords to throw at the search that will get me that article because I've already written it. I vaguely remember the titles and that kind of stuff. Real people don't search like that. They search randomly. They pull in entire questions into the search field. And of course, the results then vary depending on just exactly how flexible the search engine is. The thing that we were coming to just before we started the show was that wouldn't it be nice if AI were doing a better job of helping us solve this problem? I don't know if you want to describe the steps that you're going through offline when you answer questions, but I think it was an interesting, I want to call it a triple jump to an answer, right? It's do this, do this, do that, and then poof, some search results come out that you can then share with with whoever's asking your question.
Yeah, I've had a similar journey as you. My site's also WordPress, and it I've never been able to use the WordPress search though, because of an odd thing about how my site, macmost.com, works. And that is that my like each video, I post mostly videos, and each video is basically a database entry in a custom database. Because I've got, where's the video located? Because it's on a, video serving site. And where's the YouTube video? And what's the title of the video and all that stuff that's not typical WordPress post stuff. WordPress posts are usually all this text. Somebody would write a bunch of stuff. And one of the things is the description. So instead of actually putting in the post the description, I have that in my database. And then the post itself is just a little tiny piece of code that says, this is video 2512. And it then my code then goes and gets the description and the title and everything from that. So when WordPress goes to search, all it sees for that post is just this one little number. Doesn't see that it's about iMovie or Keynote or whatever. It can't grasp onto what's there for searching. So I experimented with using Google, just like you were saying. I never really liked it, and they kept changing it over the years and everything. Anyway, so I built my own, which just goes directly to my database and really takes like the search terms and then goes to the database and tries to do a kind of database SQL query type of search, which isn't great because it doesn't do all of the things that like something like Google will do, interpreting the language, figuring out what the key words in the question are. None of that. It's just looking at each word and it's saying how frequently are these words appearing in this thing. I was able to tweak it a lot and say, hey, words in the title matter more than words in the description, that kind of thing. But it's a search that it works and produces a nice list of videos that are results, but the results are sometimes good and sometimes not. Like sometimes if you search for like iMovie transitions or something, and if there's a video that's got iMovie transitions in the title, boom, it's going to be number one. Especially if it's a recent video. That's another thing is it prioritizes age too. So it won't try to show like a 10-year-old video that is a great keyword match over a 1-year-old video that is a okay keyword match. Yeah. So it kind of works, but I know it's also kind of not working sometimes. But I don't have another good solution. Like one of the things that I've done in the past, I don't know if I'm doing it now, to be honest, is I provided like a little link where you could do a Google search. Like so you search for on my site for it, and in addition to like getting the results, there's a little like, oh, you could also ask Google this. I don't think I am doing it now, yeah, because that would show Google ads, and it'll be at Google's site on that for that. It's the typical thing. If you go to Google and you type like site colon macmost.com space and then your search term, then it's telling Google, yeah, do a search, but only give me results from this one website. And the search results are really good, except you have all the ads. Maybe I should revisit that, but maybe I should revisit it using like DuckDuckGo or something
I was
people
going to
don't
say
mind as much.
some of the other
I could maybe
alternative search engines.
sleep a little better at night, maybe throwing people over to DuckDuckGo or Ecosia or something like that
The
rather than Google.
other thing
Yeah.
is to see if you could encode, what is it, the UDM14 parameter. You've seen UDM14.com, right? Which basically gives
Oh, yeah.
you, it uses Google still.
Yeah.
It's a front end to Google, but it gives you the traditional, 10 blue links, they call it. That might be an interesting approach to see if that gets you
That could be
something
interesting
cleaner.
too. Now this led, before we started the video, this led to an interesting thing. It's because another aspect of search for me is when I search my own site, which is something you have to do if you've been building a site for as long as either of us have. It's like number one, we can't always remember what it is we've done articles or videos on. Number two, we certainly don't know where they're like, we can't get to them that easily, right? So if somebody asks us a question, it's very likely we're going to say, I did something on that. I want to send that person the link. So what's the fastest way for me to get from here's the question I'm going to paste the link in. So one of the things I've got is most of my questions come over on YouTube. I've got a little Keyboard Maestro shortcut on my Mac that will take whatever text is selected. So the person asks a question, and during the question, they say iMovie transition, right? So I highlight iMovie transition, and then I hit this keyboard shortcut. It takes those words and performs a search in my web browser on YouTube in my channel specifically. So it's just building a URL and it's putting the search text as iMovie transition. So my result is the same as if I were to go to YouTube, go to my channel, say I want to search it, and then type that in. And then hopefully the first result is a link right there to the YouTube video. And if it's a YouTube question, then I could just copy and paste and I'm done. But sometimes it's not as simple. Sometimes somebody will describe they're looking for something and they're not using the right words. And I know I've done a video on that, but searching for the words they're using is going to help. So I started using AI and I built a thing where it I highlight select the words I want from their question. Then I run the little keyboard shortcut that runs an actual Mac shortcut. And Mac shortcuts have, it's kind of the scripting thing you can do on a Mac. One of the things you can have there, if you have the Chat GPT app installed, is you get a little Chat GPT action and you could just feed it a prompt. So I take that text and I don't feed it directly. I actually add a bunch of text to it. And the text I add is something like, a user has asked me a question that follows. Look on my instead. Well, first I had look on my YouTube channel and tell me which video most best matches this. But ChatGPT wasn't really good at that. If it was a really popular video at my channel, it would work. But in a more obscure video, it wouldn't come up with the right video. So I said, look at this question and come up with a 5 to 10 word search term for a YouTube channel that would come up with the correct video. So it takes what they said, comes up with a short search term, and then I take that and then I do the search, and that nails it most of the time.
Awesome.
It just takes 5 seconds or so for it to do all that, call Chat GPT and all that. It was interesting because I never thought I would have a use for those little mini models. ChatGPT has
Oh,
a thing where
right.
you can choose a model, and it's like, oh, yeah. So I'm like, why would I not choose the biggest, baddest, best one to give a result? Well, because they're a little slower, but I'm always like, well, if I want the right answer, I'm going to want to wait 2 more seconds. But here, I'm just asking it for it to come up with the search query, not the answer. So
Okay.
I said, yeah, give me the mini model of this because you'll be faster at doing it.
Yeah,
Anyway, it's
you
a
don't
really
need the
interesting thing.
reasoning that's in those bigger models either. It's not like they
Right.
need to reason an answer. They just need to essentially do what boils down to a form of translation.
Translation. Yeah. And also it takes into account, oh, so this is a YouTube search on a YouTube channel about this. I mean, it's going to know, if somebody's asking, how do I do a video transition from this to this? It's going to get the idea that, oh, it's talking about Macs, talking about probably iMovie, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it works really well. It's not the kind of thing like, I could build out to be on my site. Like, if I put it on my site where somebody did a search and it actually, the prompt was, somebody's searching my site, come up, improve on their search query to get a better result. Well, then I'd have a whole API issue, right? I have like 300 people a day searching my site. I'd be querying ChatGPT all those times. So it's a very different process if it's just you doing it. And I'm going to do it, 6 times a day or whatever, as opposed to building it for your site. And it's going to be done hundreds of times a day. But it was an interesting process and an interesting use of AI that once again does not, it has nothing to do with plagiarism. It's got nothing to do with deep fakes. It's got nothing to do with, get the facts wrong. And it's just basically saying, improve this and make it a search query. And it's, works really well.
What I'm wondering is, at some point, I mean, ChatGPT we think of as a large language model that we ask questions of and get answers. They've introduced this concept of searching the web over the last few months, but they're still, I can't really think of them as a search engine yet. However, sites like Perplexity, their search engine first with, the LLM and other AI models, built in later. I'm wondering if something as simple as a site colon operator added to an AI-based search engine like Perplexity might get us closer, might get us a lot closer to getting the answers on our own sites more directly.
Yeah, it definitely. I hope it's one of the reasons too that I'm not spending too much time on this now.
Oh,
Like,
yeah.
how can I improve my search? I'm like, I think I feel the strategy now is wait and see what tools come up in the next few months,
Yeah, because
year
you
or
know
two.
that there are some good tools coming down. There really
Yeah.
are, given just the velocity of the changes that have been happening in the space. It's pretty interesting. But yeah, I mean, I've actually, you've given me some ideas of things to try that I haven't been. So we'll see what if I can end up improving what goes on Ask Leo. But you're right, I don't want to engage with an API. I don't want to have it automatically engage with an API every time somebody asks a question. That's just not tenable. So you mentioned videos.
Yes.
It's in, it interests, but it enters another aspect of what it is you and I do that on one hand, it seems uber geeky and very, very focused on, entrepreneurs that host their own websites and do their own things. But I also know that a lot of people are also insanely curious at times about exactly how some of that stuff goes on in the background. So what I wanted to talk about was a little bit of the way that I've changed some of my video hosting, and then as a side effect, some of the server moves that I've done for a couple of my other clients. I am currently using on Ask Leo, if you go to a one of my sites or one of my articles that has a video, down at the bottom there will be a link to, I'm sorry, an embed of the YouTube version of the video for that article. Unless you are signed in to the Ask Leo site and you're a patron of some sort, you've purchased ad-free Ask Leo. Well, I can't guarantee that YouTube videos are going to be ad-free, so I then display an embed of the video hosted out on Vimeo. I know that you have, do, still used to use Vimeo quite a bit.
For my courses, I use it, yeah.
Yeah. And right now I'm using it. Like I said, right now it's the primary stuff for folks that are signed in and patrons. It's just my way of avoiding giving them ads when I
Of
promised I
course.
wouldn't. However, what I've started to do, again, for my courses, I just finished the switch over yesterday, is I'm now hosting the videos on essentially an online storage service. Now, this boils down to there being actually two different ways to host videos online. You can host them like any other file. It's just a file. Like you host your images, like you host your other stuff. It's just a file stored on a server somewhere. And when the video is referenced, it's that file that then gets downloaded somehow, and then streamed to the screen. The other kind of hosting, though, is literally video hosting, which is what YouTube does, which is what Vimeo does, and as it turns out, what this other provider also offers. Video hosting is ever so slightly different. You end up uploading your video to the service, of course, but then they run a bunch of transcoding in the background so that in fact they store multiple versions of your video. The versions are selected then either at the beginning of a play or even can be switched during the play based on the quality of the internet connection. So if you're on a slow, horrible internet connection, then you'll probably end up with a lower quality video because the lower quality video means that they have to push fewer bytes down the line. Like I said, that's how YouTube works. You can always, you've probably seen it on YouTube videos. You get to choose the quality. It tries to do a good job of guessing what you want at the beginning, and I think it can change along the way. But like I said, there's several different qualities. I'm not doing that. I've decided for the courses, at least as the experiment, to just host them as files. I don't have a fancy player. I'm using HTML5, the embedded video tags, to generate what boils down to a very simple bit of code that displays the video, displays the thumbnail, gives people the opportunity to hit the play button. They can go full screen if they want to. They can do all sorts of those kinds of things. But there's not this overhead of some cumbersome player that is adding all this other features, all these other features and functionality that isn't being used. So far, I've actually been really pleased with that. The one thing that I did learn is that I've been producing my videos at too high a quality. By that I mean that when they come out of my video editor, be it either Camtasia or DaVinci Resolve, they're actually pretty big. They're nice, they're sharp and good quality and all that kind of stuff, but they're overkill for what really needs to get delivered online. So I've been running Handbrake to basically transcode them to the same format with different quality settings. And then uploading that. So that basically also means that the files themselves are smaller than they than they originally were. It's been an interesting approach. The service that I'm using is called bunny.net, BUNNY.net. There's no E. I'm using them for a couple of different things, but one of them right now is just plain old storage. It's just a place to put bits. It's the kind of a thing that we could do on our own servers if we wanted to. It's the same kind of thing you could use Amazon S3 for if you wanted to. There's a bunch of different things you can use this with. But like I said, there's nothing complicated about it. It's just a place to put files. And it seems to be working well for me. Now, I know you've been down some of these branches, some of these paths before, and I'm kind of curious how this all sounds to you.
Well, I'm actually also using bunny.net, but I'm using what you talked about before. I'm using their streaming service. So their player, they are transcoding it, and it's all like a separate little service they've got. You know, when I log on to bunny.net, there's, you know, exactly what you're using there for storing files. And I'm going over to the video streaming portion of it. Which works out great. It gives me a nice player. I'm able to upload the transcript to the player, so there's closed captioning. I set a lot of things up for the player to look good and all of that. And I get I it's been really good. Actually, I've used Vimeo in the past, and I still am using them for my courses. I haven't really gotten any had any issues with people having trouble in probably the last year. But for years before that, I would get occasionally people having trouble, which the whole point of using something like Vimeo was I didn't want any trouble. Like,
What kind of
have a
trouble?
good, just people saying that the video would stop in the middle, or that the quality was bad, or, you know,
Interesting.
there would be things like the typical things you would think, and it's like, oh, I want Vimeo to handle this and it not be an issue for me. And it wasn't that often. You know, 99% was perfect. And then it was just, but enough to be an issue, especially with courses when people are paying for something. But come to think of it, I have not, it's been a while since I've gotten a complaint like that. And I've had a whole, you know, big course launch and everything like that. Never really. So they've just probably gotten better and better and better. Bunny.net, the problem with Vimeo is the pricing model doesn't work for the volume for my regular videos, which I've talked about before. They have,
It's
they
great
had,
for up to a certain threshold, and then it just
And
loses
then it's,
all sense. Yeah.
yes, yeah. Because they had, it used to be basically unlimited. And then they were like, oh, it's unlimited, except if you use a lot. Like, you know, that was what, it was basically a technical term, use a lot, you know, which apparently I was. But then they, you know, there's a lot of outcry. So they were like, they put numbers on it. And I forget, I think it's like 5 terabytes a month or something like that. It was some amount that if I started using Vimeo for my regular videos, I would cross that threshold, not by a lot, not by an order of magnitude, but I would go like 20 or 30% over it as I was even at the time. And the funny thing was, is I just expected, well, that's okay. The prices are good. I will just pay whatever the overage cost is. Well, they didn't have any overage costs. It was simply, if you go above this, talk to us about enterprise solutions, blah, blah, blah. And then I was like, you know, that's fine too. I'll talk to you. But I would expect, like, for instance, just let me pay double for double the amount of bandwidth, and I'll be fine. Like, that's the price is still good for me, and it'll be fine. And they were like, no, we don't have that. It's going to cost like 50 times more.
Yeah,
Like
it
it
was
was like
horrible.
ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I was like, but wait a minute, I could just have two separate accounts. I put odd numbered videos on one account and even numbered videos on another account, and I'd pay twice as much and it would be fine. It would just be a little pain on my end. And they were like, I guess you could, but we're still going to charge you 50 times the amount if you just want to do it normally. So I was like, fine. So I looked for a while for another solution. And I did actually what you did for a while. I just had plain videos that were just served up on my site. But then I eventually, there were a lot of services that were kind of circling around the solution. Like it was like, oh, your guys are almost there, but not quite. And Bunny.net was the first one that I was like, this looks actually like what I want. And I tried them, and I've been using them for, oh, it's been well over a year, maybe 2 years now. And it's good. I pay a reasonable amount
Yeah, they're not horribly
for,
expensive in comparison. They're actually
and
really
I have
good.
not had, really had any problems. It's been really good. So, matter of fact, I got somebody complaining today about the YouTube video looking. People like to use the term out of focus when what's really happening is it's low resolution, right? You know, their bandwidth has been detected as being low, slow, so they get a low resolution version. It's not like the video can be out of focus, like, oh, you're getting an out of focus version of it, like the projector at YouTube isn't working correctly. But I've never gotten that with any of the videos that have been served up through bunny.net. So that's really good.
I
And
do have
I've
a
been pretty happy
question
with it. Yeah.
about about the transition you described here a moment ago. You went from, plain, just host the file and embed the
Yes.
file
Yes.
versus using their streaming. Why'd you make that change?
Well, I never made the change. With bunny.net, I was always streaming.
Oh, okay.
I was using another service
Okay.
to do just to host the files while I was trying to figure things out. Bunny.net, I looked and I said, the streaming service is what I want. I wanted a nice player. I wanted the player to have features and all of that.
So here's the problem I have with it's not Bunny.net's streamer, it's
Yeah.
Vimeo's, and heck, it's YouTube for
Yeah.
that matter. And I'm actually encountering it right now. If I just host the files, I put them behind my own domain name,
Yeah.
which means then that I can move those files anywhere without having to change anything else, right? All
Yes.
I really need to do is say, you know what? The files that were at bunny.net right now, well, my domain points to their server. Now we'll move them to, say, S3, and I'll just change the domain to point to that. What I'm discovering now, of course, is that as I make this change out of Vimeo, because these courses were hosted at Vimeo, I'm having to relocate the original videos. I'm having to re-upload them. I'm having to do all that stuff. And the references that I put into my site are not my identifiers. They are Vimeo video numbers or YouTube identifiers.
Yes.
Whereas if I'm hosting it myself, the identifier that I'm using is the file name. And the file name's not going to change again, regardless of where I end up hosting this in the future. So that's what's kind of driven me to the solution I'm playing with right now, is that I want that flexibility in the future. I'm reluctant to once again tie myself to another specific video streaming service simply by the nature of, how the embeds work.
So it's funny that you bring that up because this ties back to our previous discussion about the searching of the website. And remember, I mentioned that all my stuff's like kind of in my own database.
Yes.
So I foresaw this issue because when I started in 2007, YouTube was not even, it wasn't a clear winner at all,
Right.
right? It was one of many services. Matter of fact, I think my first videos were uploaded to six different video services like Blip.tv and Fiddler, and I mean there was
I
all these
remember those,
services.
yes.
So when I came up with this, I'm going to do a database idea, I wanted to get around that. And so the database contains all of these references. So like right now I actually upload to three places: YouTube, bunny.net, and archive.org. And at archive.org, I'm purely doing it now for just archiving, permanent archiving. But I did in the past have like a podcast feed and that link to those files and stuff. And so basically everywhere I'm uploading it to, I'm putting a database entry in there. So all I need to do is look at like my entry for video 3215. And I've got all those in there, including the name of the original file, like the file that it is on my drive, and I archive it to my, and back it up and all that. So I know the original name of the file was something. I know that the bunny.net ID is this. I know the YouTube ID is this. And I know the full URL to the one at archive.org is this. That's all there. And I actually have code for each one of those. So if I wanted to say, instead of showing, a video as being at bunny.net, I wanted to show it at the YouTube embed. All I need to do is change one line of code. And all of a sudden, all of the videos at MacMost are going to all of a sudden be YouTube embeds. And
So,
or I could change them to be showing the video from archive.org.
I'm kind of there except without the database.
Yeah.
The way that I embed videos into AskLeo.com is not by using the YouTube embed code or even the
Yeah.
Vimeo embed code. I have a short code, a
Short code.
WordPress
Yep. Short
short
codes
code
are what I used to.
with code that I've written in the
Yeah.
back that says, okay, the parameters you pass to it are the YouTube ID, the Vimeo ID, and eventually now it'll be something else that we'll use for the bunny.net ID. But so I can make all those same kind of changes. It's just that the database, I guess, is distributed throughout my content. Right.
Yes, and actually, so there's a way, if I was going to start today, I would, instead of using my own database system, I would simply use the custom fields in WordPress.
Right.
And so, and actually, I have used the, I do use the custom fields in WordPress, like going back to say maybe the last 1,000 videos. I use them for a lot of stuff. It doesn't go back all the way to the beginning like my own database does. But like there are things that are in those custom fields. So if I was to start over again, I would just put all of those things, so sort of like the ID for bunny.net or the YouTube ID, just put those in the custom fields and use them like that, or even just have like a field in a custom field that is like a list of line by line of different IDs, because they all kind of can be recognized. Like the YouTube IDs look like YouTube IDs. You can
Yes.
even just do a you can even just do a full URL. It's just youtube.com/, and then the whole thing. And then just put that on a line. And then you just have code, like a short code that is basically like the short code could be something like a display video. And what it does is then it goes to your custom code and says, oh, so you want, so your favorite right now is bunny.net. So I'm going to look in the custom fields, find a bunny.net ID, build the code, the HTML code that needs to go into embed it, and do that. And then you can have in your code. But the fallback is, there's no bunny.net ID, use the YouTube one as the fallback and display that. But then you could go and change it later on. So if you start saying, oh, I've discovered a great new service, so that's going to be priority one. And if that's not there, bunny.net is there. Or maybe don't use bunny.net anymore, but go to YouTube. So you could still do everything I'm doing now without my own custom database, just with the fields, the custom fields in WordPress. And
Interesting.
that's how I would do it now. I already have the database. It's already kind of nice, and I use it for a whole bunch of other things.
Right. And I've
But
already got my short code as, with all the
yeah.
parameters that it takes. And
Yeah.
so.
So yeah, so there's so anyway, lots of cool behind the scenes stuff on how our sites work today.
So, in another piece of behind the scenes that has absolutely nothing to do with AskLeo or MacMost, it's just server geeking out. One of the things that Gary and I have both done over the years is moved. We moved from one hosting company to another, from one server to another, from one server operating system to another. It happens. It's just one of those things that is, I want to say it's the cost of doing business, but it is the reality of hosting a website like ours, out on the internet. And I'd also maintain websites for a couple of, well, one's technically a client, a volunteer organization that I volunteer for, and the other one is something just completely off the wall. But I ended up doing a server move for both of these in the last 6 months, and I thought it was kind of interesting. I had been hosting both of them in separate accounts out at InMotion Hosting. They're virtual private servers, which means that they look like a complete server, from start to finish. You boot it, you reboot it, you do all those kinds of things. Even though you might be on shared hardware, everything else is completely unseen. You just look like you're using a dedicated machine. The contract was coming up, and I decided to look elsewhere for something cheaper. And we discovered Contabo is another hosting site that we ended up doing this cheaper, equivalent hardware, great stuff. So the reason I bring it up at all is because it's a server move with a change embedded in it. There's server management software called cPanel, or Webmin, but cPanel is the name that it usually goes by. And even if you've ever yourself done shared hosting through Bluehost or GoDaddy or any of those others, typically what you're looking at when you manage your own website is an interface that is a variation of or a subset of cPanel. The problem, if you will, with cPanel is that it's closed source, it's costly, it's an added cost, and they raised their cost not that long ago. So that actually was one of the contributing factors to the original cost that I was trying to move away from. There's an equivalent server management package called Webmin or VirtualMin that allows you to manage your server and your websites on that server through a web interface. I've been using it on Ask Leo for like at least 2, 3 years, if not longer. So I decided to make that change. But it's one thing to move servers, but it's another thing to change the server management software out from underneath you as you do that. One of them, you can bundle up a cPanel backup, and Webmin knows to suck it up and basically replicate everything in its version of the world as compared to how cPanel organizes things. And that worked like 99%. The 1% was interesting because even though they were quote unquote the same operating system, in this case, I went from Ubuntu Linux to Ubuntu Linux, different versions, but each of these packages assumes certain software. Now they can assume things like Apache for web servers. Great, not a problem. Translates easy. But they had different assumptions about mailers. cPanel likes to work with EXIM, EXIM. Webmin likes to work with PostFix. Same idea, but a completely different approach, a completely different solution. So it had to do some of the translation from EXIM configuration to figure out the correct equivalent PostFix configuration. And again, 99%, 95%. But of course, I did end up spending a fair amount of time ironing out some of the differences because forwards didn't work exactly the same and accounts were handled a little differently. So the one server, it had like a handful of email accounts and forwarders, and that actually transitioned pretty well. The website itself went well. We had some issues with the various email configurations because this is an organization of people that interact with each other, and we've got different ways we make ourselves available publicly. So that took a fair amount of work. Then the other one was both simpler and more complex. It's simpler in that it has a tiny website, but it has 1,000 email accounts. And migrating 1,000 email accounts is nerve-wracking at best. When you're doing this kind of a change, it's actually quite nerve-wracking. But it actually went relatively smoothly. The one that moved, the 1,000 email account one is a server or a service for ex-Microsoft employees. One of the things you kind of are known by, especially if you were there early, was your email address. For example, my very first email address ever was leon@microsoft.com. And people knew you by your email address. When you leave the company, of course, it would be nice to be findable somehow. So what this service is allows ex-Microsoft employees to come along and say, "Hey, here's my old email address. Can you give me that alias, Leon, on this other domain?" And that's what we do. And we've got, like I said, 1,000 people who are doing that. But it's interesting. I learned a lot. And in fact, one day I woke up and one of the servers, I think it was the Microsoft one, decided that it didn't want to do IPv4 anymore. It was IPv6 only. For some reason, I have no idea what happened. The configuration for IPv4 went away, but what that meant is that it was functionally unreachable from just about everywhere because IPv6 just isn't quite as ubiquitous as we might want it to be. So I learned a lot about Linux networking that day. But those servers are up and running and solid. And like I said, using webmin slash virtualmin to manage their content, it's been a very good result. I'm really, really happy with where we are. And now all of my servers, I have four servers that I manage myself, two Ask Leo, my personal server, and then these two other ones. They're all being managed by the same server management software, and I'm not dealing with cPanel anymore. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing for people that are curious about what goes on in the background. Even when it's not necessarily related to the business, we're still, I at least am still playing with this stuff, almost 24 hours a day.
Yeah, I went the opposite direction the last time I moved servers, which was probably less than a year ago. It just got down to the server I was using. I had wrote it out its whole life, like I don't know if it was 5 years or 7 years or something. But I got it when it was like I moved from one server to another and got the latest, greatest, newest everything, and that eventually got to the point where, and I was using, I am still using Liquid Web. Where they said, yeah, it's got to go. You need to move, to. So I decided, even though I'm paying more than I could be paying, I decided to just go straight from like to like, stick with cPanel, and just go straight across to a new server, stuck with Liquid Web, just tried to make it the easiest path possible. I don't. I'm at the a weird amount of time I spend with servers is like I don't use them often enough that I or I guess I use them just often enough so I get used to things like how cPanel works and things like that it would be hard to transition. And I don't use them often enough that it's like I would come up to speed really quickly on a new one. I would probably go months without having to do something. And then when I tried to do it, I'd be like, well, this is all new and now I have to dig into it again. So I just felt more comfortable just spending the money. And going and cPanel now is like a license, and like one of the annoying things is that the way the license works is I pay extra because I have more than 10 websites,
Yes,
10
that's what did me
accounts,
in on them originally when I left.
right?
Actually, when I
I've
also
got
left Liquid Web.
like literally 11 accounts, and the thing that sucks is that I don't need 11 accounts. I could probably do it all with just one account, and probably a better number would be like three, and then just have some of those websites under those accounts. But in order to do that, there's work that needs to be done. So it's like, okay, I've got 11 accounts and 11 sites. Actually, I think it's more like 11 accounts and like 15 sites or whatever. It's like I need to take some of those other sites, move them as subdomains, and then there's always some issue with one or the other. And I'm like, some other time when I have time. So I just continue to pay. It's not, I wouldn't say it's a premium at all. I'd say it's a moderate amount, not a bargain for Liquid Web just to do everything I want. And it just did show off some moving pains. Like we were talking about, like, it's not MySQL anymore. It's what MariaDB or whatever.
MariaDB, yep.
And fortunately that was painless, right? To go from one to the other. I had no problems whatsoever. But so there were a few things. I think my biggest problem was that some of my sites send out emails. Like for instance, if I were to somebody were to ask me a question at a MacMost and then I respond to their question, they get a little email that sends out and says, hey, there's a response to your question over here. And the server sends that out via a script. And And those kept working just fine, except that there were all these weird things that you need to do to set up email, reverse DNS, and all this to
Reverse
get it
DNS,
to.
DKIM, SPF, DMARC.
Oh,
Yes, I'm
so
all
these
too
are all
well
like
versed in those. Yes.
anti-spam stuff, right?
Yes.
So the idea was that, more than half of the people would just get it normally, right? The server just says, send it out. They get the email. It all works fine. But then some people, their email service provider would say, hey, this email says it's from macmost.com, but I thought macmost.com was at this IP address. And it's actually at this IP address. And it looks suspicious. And I'm just not going to bother delivering it or telling anybody that about it or whatever. So I get people that were like, I never got the email for, like, I signed up for a course. I never got the email with the login or whatever. And so it just took a while to like remember where that stuff was and make all the changes that needed to be made and let that propagate. And that was a
One of
pain.
the problems I run into is, of course, when you move servers, you end up with a new IP address for that server. And it's kind of a gamble because you're also, at least initially, inheriting that IP address's reputation, which, especially for email, then can be very significant. As it turns out, the server that we have for the nonprofit, Microsoft email servers do not like me. Just period. I can send whatever I want from that server to anybody else, but Microsoft servers will bounce it because they don't like us. And that is one of the other things you end up having to deal with when you do this kind of stuff. It doesn't matter that I've got all the SPF and the DKIMs and the DMARCs and the PTRs all set up correctly. Doesn't matter. That IP address Microsoft considers to be evil. So what I ended up having to do was, when sending to a Microsoft domain, and only when sending to a Microsoft domain, route it through a different email provider. Which, like you said, okay, I've done that before. It was about 2 years ago. I had to relearn how to do that. Because it is possible. One of the complications, by the way, that I'm facing with these is that my personal organization is very simple. I want AskLeo to have a dedicated server. I want that thing to be as beefy and as strong as is appropriate for that site because that's the bread and butter. I've probably got 30, 40 other websites, but they're on a separate server. So they're shared with all that kind of stuff. The Microsoft one and the nonprofit one, they're on each their own server. And that's very intentional because if something ever happens to me, or if there's, if something ever changes, I need to be able to hand off that package without having to disentangle it from my own existing infrastructure. So that's why they get their own setup.
Yep, so it's just part of the life of running websites and stuff. Of course, so many people that deal with that are our competitors, or more likely our peers, really not competing, don't even deal with this anymore. Set up a YouTube channel, go with a podcast service, go to Patreon, go to Substack, right? And they've got their whole online, like so many times I see interesting people on social media and I'm like, oh, they have interesting content. They write some interesting stuff. What's their site? They don't have a site.
Which
They have an
worries the heck out of
Instagram
me, especially, I mean, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago with respect to the TikTok ban. All your eggs are in somebody else's basket.
Yeah.
And even if I were posting on Substack or some of the other platforms, I know that I do host my videos on YouTube, but all of my videos are also on Vimeo. So if I were to ever lose my YouTube account for whatever reason, like you said, you just go in and you change a little bit of code on the back end of the server, and all of a sudden all your videos on your site are still being displayed from a different source. It worries me that people are relying so heavily on third parties without building their own base, but we'll see.
Yeah,
We shall
exactly.
see.
All
So,
right.
where do you want to go next?
Yeah. We just go right into Ain't It Cool, really. I mean,
Okay,
I
sounds
think we've
good.
got yeah, we've
Well,
covered
actually, I want to
plenty
get
in
off
this
my lawn
episode.
first.
You want to do okay, let's
Let's
yell at some people.
So one of the things that I've been dealing with for honestly months, but it's gotten worse lately, is Microsoft pushing features in Windows that people don't want. The canonical example right now is that they are pushing Copilot, their AI offering, very, very heavily. It's showing up in the operating system. It's showing up as an application. It's showing up in the browser. It's showing up in Microsoft Office. And the big challenge for me, of course, is great, I get to write articles about how to try and turn it off everywhere. But it got me to thinking, wouldn't it be novel if Microsoft and other companies that feel the need to push their features, wouldn't it be novel if they just made their features so good and so compelling that they could offer them as a choice and people would want to turn them on. They would want to engage with them. As it is, the fact that they're ramming it down everybody's throat honestly makes me believe that they don't have enough faith in their own product to be assured that people would, in fact, choose it. Like I said, just make it good and we'll use it. If it's not good and we don't want it, you're losing reputation and causing a heck of a lot of frustration by forcing it on us. I don't know that we'll ever get there. I think for a lot of these companies, they're too entrenched in their ways, but it would be nice.
Yeah.
It would be nice.
I want to revisit a complaint here that you originally had and I agreed with, but I've just seen it a few times recently. The whole thing with getting a question that's basically a why question, somebody asking why. Why does Apple do it this way? Why is this? Why does it work like this and all that? And it's a weird question. I hate getting why questions because what I want to scream back is like, what difference does it make?
Yes.
It's like knowing why is not going to change how, that's not what you want. What you want is there, you want a better, like think of a how question, like how can you get around it? How can you do it differently? How can you make this work for you? Whatever it is. Why, knowing why doesn't help. But at the same time, it's okay to be curious. Like, if you want to know, like, wow, why is it like this? Why does this app, why do all video editors have a timeline? Like, why? Why is that the way? And there are answers to these things sometimes. And sometimes the answers are fascinating. And maybe that's the only purpose of the person asking why, is they're just curious, inquisitive. But often, I'm feeling most of the time it's not. They're actually just complaining. But instead
Exactly.
of saying, I don't like this. They're saying, why is it like this? And it's
Yes.
like, I'd rather you say, I don't like it like this. I wish they would do it some other way instead
Right.
of saying, why do they do it like this? Because it's like, oh, I don't know. Are you asking me, like, should I be researching this and coming up with an answer? Maybe, you shouldn't care. And maybe you don't. You've just phrased this poorly. So it's a really, it's the kind of thing, it doesn't make me angry to get the questions. It stops me in my tracks. It does. I'm going through like, okay, 50 new YouTube comments. Let's get through them. And I get to number 25 and it's like, why is this like that? And I'm like, dead stop. Oh,
Oh
should
no,
I
I'm
try
the
to
opposite.
interpret?
I'm the next comment. Just move on.
I mean, it's like, should I try to interpret? Should I and try to take this as a how question? Like
Right.
reinterpret it? Should I try to give them an answer? Sometimes there's an answer, but do they care? Do they really asking because they care? It's a very tough thing. So it's like, oh, I just wish the why questions would just not appear in the first place.
I think that sometimes it's certainly the minority of times, but sometimes the why question may or may not be legit or genuine, right? They may just be complaining. But sometimes the answer can help them accept what they're faced with, right? Generally, when they're complaining, that's not the case, but sometimes it can.
And I don't want to miss those opportunities.
Right,
That's the
exactly, which
thing.
is why we read
Sometimes
the
it's,
questions. Yeah.
yeah, why we, and why sometimes I want, but sometimes it is like, I don't know, if I don't know the answer offhand of a how question, I can, be like, I don't know what buttons you hit for that. but give me 1 minute here, and I
Right.
find it. But the why question, it's like, oh, do I really want to start? Because I might be able to find the why in 1 minute, or it might be the next hour.
Well,
And at
and
what
some of
point
them
do
are
I give up?
unanswerable. Like, why is Microsoft pushing Copilot so hard? That's a very, very deep, complicated, and honestly unknown answer, right? That boils down to philosophy and marketing and business practices and God only knows what. And that's a question, honestly, that's a question I am getting from time to time is why are they doing this? I don't know. My usual answer is it doesn't matter why they're doing it. It is what it is. What we need to focus on is what we do with it.
A lot of times too, it's like, why doesn't this feature exist? Or why isn't this an option? And the answer comes down to, well, if that's an option, then maybe there are 100 other similar things. Like a simple thing would be like, why can't I export in these four video formats, but not the fifth one that I want? Well, okay, but then there's the fifth one. What about the sixth one? What about the 100 others that other people want? Like, why is yours more special than other people's? Maybe you have a good answer for that. Maybe you could say, hey, it's the third most popular video format. It should be there. But it's like at some point, it's like, oh, okay. So maybe Apple should build out, instead of four export options, a control panel with all sorts of different things, but at some point it's like, well, now this is going to delay the product, and this is going to confuse people, and this is going to get people asking other why questions, like what do bits per second mean, things like that. So you'd see that's a it, what I just went through was a really good example of why it's hard to answer why questions.
Yes,
So yeah,
exactly.
ask us what 6 times 7 is instead of a why question, so we can answer and
Why
know
is
it's right.
on the flip side, ain't it cool? So I was really hoping to be able to come in here today and to be very effusive about White Lotus. The first episode of the third season aired last night or the night before, and we watched it, and we will continue to watch it. I was disappointed. And it dawned on me that the reason I was disappointed is that so far there's not one character I care about. Which for me turns out to be actually important as I watch these various shows. So I'm hoping that that'll change. So in the meantime, then, what I did enjoy that just wrapped up was the latest Dexter series. The original Sin, which is basically Dexter's origin story. And it's good on so many levels, so many levels. One of the things, I don't know, did you ever watch Dexter?
No, I have
Oh,
not.
okay. So Dexter is, he's a police blood spatter analyst. In the original series, he's a police blood spatter analyst, except he's also a serial killer. And he has a code, so he's only killing people that deserve it. And certainly through the episodes, you end up agreeing that, yes, that person deserves it. So this is, like I said, his origin story. One of the things they did that's really hard when you travel back in time for characters that are established like that is coming up with actors to play their younger versions. And they nailed it. They managed to get like two or three actors who have managed to capture the expressions, the mannerisms, the approach that the original actors had in the original series to a wonderful, wonderful degree. It really is believable that yes, this actor who's playing Dexter today is in fact, he is representing the Dexter of the future. So anyway, if you like serial killers, if you like serial killer murder mystery type things, Dexter actually was Dexter Origins or Original Sin, I think is what it's called now, is highly recommended for those who are into that kind of thing. I enjoyed it.
I got to go with for this week, the Saturday Night Live 50th anniversary stuff. It was a whole weekend filled with stuff, actually weeks leading up to it with documentaries and everything. I'm a huge SNL fan. Been watching it since I was a kid. I'm not old enough. I should not be old enough to have watched like original season stuff, but it turns out I am, because I even saw one of the episodes of the original season. I think a distant memory. I broke my arm when I was a little kid and returned from the ER late on Saturday night and was allowed to,
What?
as like, oh, it's okay. I was allowed to stay up and watch. And I believe it was one of the very first episodes of Saturday Night Live. And no idea what was going, no idea what it was about, but I it seemed funny and everybody seemed to be laughing at it. And then I just went through childhood watching it and adulthood watching it. And I so yeah, for me and my wife too, it's very very important show that we've always enjoyed. So seeing all this stuff, I thought the music concert on Friday night was fantastic that they had on. And then the show itself was, was good. But it was great. It was great to see, like, bits of history and people that were there and stuff like that. So anyway, it was a fun weekend
We
doing
watched
all that.
the what is it, 4 hour episode,
Yeah,
the live
almost.
episode, which again we enjoyed it. Obviously, it had it hits and misses, but yes, being ever so slightly older than you, we were watching the original series when it first came out, or at least watching it occasionally. It hadn't quite hit cult status at that point, but we were definitely paying attention. The thing that cracked me up the absolute most about that episode. Was Sabrina Carpenter and Paul Simon. They did a fine job on their song, but her comment
Her
that
joke, yeah.
she hadn't been born yet and her parents hadn't been born yet, that made me feel old.
I think
Right?
that was a great joke because it worked on many levels. It was funny as a joke,
Right.
but it was also poignant
Yes.
as like a statement ha having to do with the 50th anniversary
Absolutely, the longevity of the show. Yep.
special. So it was great, and yeah, it was just so it was a fun weekend. So that definitely dominated my cultural and media landscape this weekend. So I'll make it my Ain't It Cool.
Makes sense. See, self-promotion. So the question that I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago was, should I upgrade to Windows 11? The flip side of that is, what happens at Windows 10 end of support? It's askleo.com/145971. It is a an article that I recently updated as we're getting closer to that date in October. And honestly, the answer is nothing, but it's a complicated answer because. Yeah, you can keep using Windows 10. It'll be fine, but you do need to pay attention to a few more things that honestly you should have been paying attention to all along. Now you just need to make sure you're paying attention to them. So, anyway, what happens at Windows 10 end of support?
And I have got a video this week on how and why to use safe mode on a Mac. Safe mode is basically you reboot your Mac and it doesn't load any third-party extensions. So it is a good troubleshooting technique. If something isn't working right, the first thing Apple support is going to ask you to do is reboot into safe mode and then see if it's still not working right.
Right.
And that's a good test to see if it's something with the operating system or something you've installed. And it
Right.
also does a bunch of other stuff too. There are actually a bunch of diagnostics that are not done during a normal reboot because they would take too long, but they are done during a safe mode reboot as like a second thing. So sometimes just boot into safe mode and then immediately reboot into normal mode, but we'll fix actually some things. So
Interesting.
anyway, I've got it's changed how you actually do the reboot because Apple went to its own processors and everything like that, and that really changed some of the basics behind the hardware. So it's different now than if you have an older Intel Mac, how you actually boot into safe mode. It's just as easy. It's just a different sequence.
It's
So.
interesting because Windows has had a safe mode forever. It's probably similar, same idea. Basically, it doesn't load a bunch of stuff. The frustrating thing about it is that they made it incredibly difficult to get to. It still exists. In your case, it's probably a matter of, click, click here, reboots into safe mode, and you're there. With Windows, it used to be the case where you would reboot your machine, hold down F8, I think it was, as it was rebooting, and it would boot into safe mode instead of normal. Now, you'll get a kick out of this. You have to interrupt the boot process 3 times in a row. So basically, you start booting, and you hit Control Alt Delete, or you turn off the power. And then you repeat that two more times. And that third time that it comes up, it'll be in safe mode. I don't know why. Maybe this belongs up in Get Off My Lawn, but I don't know why they did this. And to actually tie it further, why ask why? It is what it is. This is how we get into safe mode. So they've done a good job of hiding it for some reason.
Interesting. Okay.
Anyway, well, that's another week. And as always, we are very grateful that you are here listening to us, all one or two of you, however many there might be. We appreciate it. As always, thanks for listening, and we will see you again, or hear you again, or talk to you again real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH241. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com.